Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to Dismantling Justice, the podcast of Envision Freedom Fund, formerly Brooklyn Community Bail Fund, where we offer insight and analysis from our community members, allies, and colleagues about issues affecting folks who encounter the racist, unjust criminal, legal, and immigration systems, and the work that we're all doing to fight for transformative change. I'm Carl Hammond Lipscomb, Executive Director of Envision Freedom, and I'm here with Saleh Israel, the creator and producer of this podcast, and Envision Freedom's Director of Special Initiatives.
Welcome back, everyone. This afternoon, we are excited to be joined by Austin Kocher from the Syracuse University, an associate professor at Syracuse University, affiliated with the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, better known as TREC, which is a research and data clearinghouse that I'm, you know, my understanding is researches a ton of issues, but I am most familiar with them, and we at Envision Freedom Fund are most familiar with them through their amazing work collecting data around immigration and on immigrants and making that data accessible to social justice organizations, to attorneys, to pretty much anyone that has an interest in the immigration field or immigration as an issue. But I'm gonna let Austin speak more about TREC. Welcome, Austin.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
No problem. Thank you so much for getting on with us, especially so last minute. But I guess I wanted to start out, I've used TREC's data and I've used TREC as a resource for many, many, many years, since I was a student, way back in the early 2000s or earlier in the 2000s. But I'd love if you could just describe TREC for us, talk to us about TREC, give like the elevator spiel, because I know of TREC is doing a ton of different things. What is TREC, and what was the impetus behind TREC being founded?
Yeah, so TREC has been around for a little bit more than 30 years now. It was founded by David Burnham, who is a New York Times reporter, and Susan Long, who's a doctor, professor here at Syracuse University. And they teamed up because they had a shared interest in using the Freedom of Information Act to make information from the federal government, government records, more available and accessible by the American public. David had a history of investigating a wide range of really interesting topics from police, law enforcement in New York City. Sue Long, who both of them are still here, by the way, they both are still co-directors. Sue is a statistician and sociologist in the School of Business and Management here, and with a real focus on statistics. And so together, they decided to, like I said, use the Freedom of Information Act, which had been around for just a little while, was still relatively new, to request data, digital records from the federal government. And it's important to emphasize just how novel and original this was and still is today. Many people use the Freedom of Information Act to get paper records from the federal government. TREC does not go after paper records. TREC goes after digital records from the federal government. And we go after really big data sets. And so, and our goal is to go after records that are of high, value, that are of high interest and value to the public and to the media, and to make sense of those data sets and to understand them, and then to make them available by writing research reports on them or producing interactive data tools, things like this. So it's kind of a nerdy data research institute, but we think of ourselves as playing a really important role in the government transparency and accountability ecosystem because of our expertise in large government data sets and in turning those into actionable information.
Thanks. TREC has a very long history in making data accessible to the public. And can you speak to us, what about your own research and interests? And, you're very active on social media around immigration issues. So I imagine that's part of your interest. But can you speak about your own scholarly interests?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, my area of research is immigration specifically. I'm a geographer by training, a political and legal geographer, with kind of an emphasis in actually in critical social theory. And my interest for over a decade has been understanding the deportation pipeline. So everything from the first time that that a migrant or a non-citizen interacts with a law enforcement official of some kind, all the way through till the end of that case, whether that person gets, you know, a green card or is allowed to stay in the country or gets asylum, or if they're, you know, ordered deported, have to leave the country. And so that entire system is something that I've spent, you know, a good part of my professional career trying to understand, not just in terms of the mechanics and the laws and all of that, but also just trying to understand, you know, what are the ideas that animate this system? How should we think about this system from a conceptual, you know, a theoretical perspective, and how is the system changing? You know, when I got into this work, you know, in 2009, it was because there was a new policy at the time called 287G, which allowed local law enforcement officials, sheriff's offices, police, police organizations, to police departments, to essentially engage in immigration enforcement as if they were federal kinds of immigration enforcement officials. And it was a really new policy. It really changed the landscape of how immigration enforcement worked in the country. And it caused a lot of alarm, I think, from civil rights, you know, advocates and immigrant rights advocates. And so that was sort of my entry into this, and just sort of getting my head around, you know, what does this mean if you can be driving down the road and, you know, Buffalo, New York, or Columbus, Ohio, you know, and get pulled over, and the next thing you know, you're in a detention center, or, you know, facing removal proceedings. So that's kind of really what animated my focus on, you know, into that. And, you know, because TRAC does, you know, TRAC is nonpartisan and nonpolitical, doesn't really get involved in politics, doesn't really get involved in partisan fights or anything like that. We really don't even do any policy advocacy of any kind, but just getting, you know, just understanding the data that we get requires a really intimate knowledge of how these immigration systems work. Because, you know, when we get the data from the government, it's not like it comes with customer service support and a manual. You know, they just give us these, you know, massive, you know, database downloads, and we have to make sense of it. And so part of making sense of it means understanding how the immigration system works at a very granular level, and then being able to, you know, like I said, make sense of the data and write about it. So that's kind of the fit between myself and TRAC. I love it because, you know, I get a real inside look at the immigration system, which is something, you know, I certainly care about, but I remain very committed and very interested and very active in research that's not just about, you know, sort of federal data, but I, you know, I continue to look at, you know, what's going on the ground and writing about some of these issues.
Amazing. There should be some sort of reunion of people that got into immigration work around 287G in 2009, because that's exactly when I got into this as well. So it's just funny to hear you bring that up and to see the different trajectories that people that were involved back then took. You know, I guess you started to get into this, but can you talk about some of TRAC's current or more recent projects and how they relate to just, you know, the current discourse, the current conversations around immigration, whether that's proposals moving in Congress, proposals coming out of the White House, efforts that you might have heard from that various groups are working on, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we, even though we are not political or partisan, we're very attentive to things that are happening, you know, obviously in Congress or policies coming out of presidential administrations. And, you know, one of the things that's really exciting about the work is because we go after really comprehensive data sets, essentially when new policies come down, we don't have to file a new FOIA request. We often already have that data. And it's more of a process of doing the research to identify the data that's there that might be relevant, rather than actually, you know, submitting new FOIA requests, because FOIA requests take so long to process by the federal government. You know, if there's a new policy by the White House today and you file a FOIA request on that today, you may not get anything back for months or years. So that's one of our sort of strategic advantages here is we ask for so much data that we often have, what's there. And then really, you know, what we try to do is just to put these conversations in context so that people have the data to have a meaningful conversation about it. I certainly don't have to tell you about how politicized, you know, the immigration debate is in this country, and oftentimes how much that conversation about immigration, you know, there are some important things to have to debate and have conversations about. There's, you know, no denying that. But there's a big part of the immigration debate that is just sort of left reality, that's just left the world of facts, you know, and just sort of taken off into an atmosphere of conspiracy and conjecture. And I guess part of what we try to do is just rein that in a little bit and say, look, we're not telling you how to think about it, but here's the data. Some things are just inaccurate, some things are just accurate, you know. So to give you an example, you know, the migrant protection protocols is something that tracks data has been used for a lot. You know, MPP was created during the Trump administration to turn asylum seekers back at the U.S.-Mexico border, send them back to Mexico to wait for their asylum hearings. And because TRAC had the data on that, TRAC was able to very quickly respond and create some new data tools that allowed the public to see on a month-by-month basis, you know, how many people are being added to the MPP program, are they getting attorneys, what is the outcome of their cases? And all of this information, this is not information that the government is making, you know, public proactively. They should, but they're not. And so TRAC played and continues to play a really important role in just saying, look, this is what's happening, you know? And so, you know, that was really important. We were able to show that, you know, that less than 2% of people in that program ever received asylum, compared to 30% of asylum seekers in the country who weren't in MPP. So that by itself paints a really clear picture. We were able to show that less than 10% of all of the people in MPP even had an immigration attorney. And as I'm sure you know, having an immigration attorney is key to asylum cases because it's very complicated law and asylum cases are complicated. That compares to, you know, well over 80, sometimes 90% of asylum cases, you know, inside the country. So we were just able to show relatively, you know, it might seem relatively simple, you know, once you see the data points, but, you know, that takes a lot of work. It's taken years and really more than a decade for TRAC to get to the point where where we have the data, we understand it well enough, and we can be responsive to that and sort of like turn on a dime and produce that data in a meaningful way. But, you know, we think that we contributed to the, you know, to the public conversation, public understanding in some way. And we certainly do that with other issues. There's debates right now about whether the immigration courts should be independent, what to do about the growing immigration court backlog, which is now more than 1.6 million people facing deportation today. We continue to publish data on alternatives to detention. You know, more immigrants today than ever are now being monitored using electronic monitoring or what some people call e-carceration technologies, not just GPS ankle monitors, but increasingly smartphones, people who are being monitored through their smartphone by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So again, we try to put that data out there, make it as legible as possible, and, you know, try to do our part to help the public understand this very complicated area of law and law, you know, immigration enforcement. We try to make it more understandable.
That's great. And it's great that TRAC has been able to carve out a bit of a niche while, you know, remaining nonpartisan, you know, still remaining relevant and useful and current. You know, the federal government, and one thing that surprised me when, you know, when I've worked on research projects in the past, is that the federal government can be, you know, a black box when it comes to data on immigration and on immigrants. I think of a few years ago, I worked on a report on black immigrants, and I was shocked that the federal government doesn't track immigration by race, which is it's just super surprising. Are there other areas like that where there are glaring omissions when it comes to either data collected or data access, you know, particularly around immigration?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And issues of race and immigration are way up there in terms of my interest. I mean, again, going back to my interest in 287G, you know, part of my interest and motivation there was concerns about racial profiling. And I recently actually just published a paper on 287G and issues of race and policing. But the same is also true for gender and sexuality, you know? How are people, you know, affected by immigration in terms of their, you know, their gender and sexuality? These are all things that the government does not track very reliably. So we, you know, we have to do the best that we can to try to make sense of what's there, given that they don't necessarily track all of these things. But I agree with you, it is very much a black box, and we're constantly trying to make as much sense as we can of the data that we get. And very often, you know, because I talk to a lot of reporters and researchers, and we work with people across the country, we often get questions about, you know, well, do you have a data on this or that? And very often the question is, well, kind of, you know, we only have what the government has. So we don't do any original data collection. It's not like we're out there doing surveys and things like that. So very often it's kind of the work for us comes in taking what the government does have and trying to connect it to important problems. And sometimes just trying to, you know, do the best that we can and paint as clear of a picture as we can in that process. But it's definitely an issue. And I'll tell you, one of the things that that I've learned a lot, you know, while being at Track 2 is just how many data management problems there are within the government. So even if the government technically has some data on, let's say, gender, you know, in fact, we never used to release gender in our immigration tools because the government just didn't fill it out. You know, only 10 or 15% of the time would they fill out gender. And by the way, by gender, they just mean male and female. So just a gender binary there. Now, in the last couple of years, they've done a much better job. And so they're now filling out that gender information, again, at least male and female, much more than they ever did. So now we're able to release it. And that, you know, it's and it helps to paint a picture. Again, it just helps to people to understand how gender plays out and how, you know, in the deportation process. But it's a constant process of just trying to shine a light on what's there. And it's definitely a challenge.
That, how easy is it for you to get data from DHS? Is there ever pushback or instances where the government is less forthcoming? And, you know, again, as an attorney, we constantly face instances where, you know, we'll send a FOIA and we'll get like a stack of documents that are completely redacted and, you know, basically useless. And then we'll have to send another FOIA or challenge it. What's your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we run into those kinds of challenges all the time. Now, some data we get and there's some very good FOIA officers. So it really depends FOIA officer by FOIA officer, agency by agency. And so we have some very good experiences with some people who are working in government too. And that's what we prefer. Again, we're not particularly exciting or controversial. We really just want to work with agencies to get what we think is our right under the law. However, immigration agencies are very politicized. They have cultures of, you know, internal cultures that are resistant, I think, to oversight, both federal oversight and public oversight. So we very often have to file multiple FOIA requests. We very often have to litigate. So we're often in court fighting, you know, the government for not responding or for withholding information that they shouldn't have. So it's not easy at all. And in fact, we have so many things that we could litigate over that the government, you know, that we believe the government is withholding unlawfully, but there's only so many FOIA attorneys in the universe. And so we have to work very, you know, gently with our FOIA attorneys because we tend to work with pro bono attorneys who are willing to help us for the, you know, the better good of society. So, but we do absolutely have to fight for it. And sometimes we have to go to the public. Sometimes we have to publicize issues in the federal government with how they're responding to FOIAs to try to pressure them that way. You know, we had an issue during the Trump administration where the data that they should have been providing on asylum was coming in each month with, you know, massive numbers of cases completely gone, just completely missing, which is a major problem because, you know, our concern was, are they deleting records? Maybe, probably not intentionally, but maybe. are they mismanaging the data? You know, are there the protocols in place to just do the work? I mean, you know, if you've got like 20 or 30 records, you know, that's, you know, managing 20 or 30 records is one thing. When you're, you know, we get almost 4 billion digital records a year, 4 billion with a B. We have got servers to manage this and all of that. So we get a lot of data, and you know, it's important for people to understand that when once you're looking at the scale of data and you're looking at millions or even billions of records, digital records, data management becomes more important. It's not just like you're losing a paper file. There's all kinds of digital technological work you have to do to make sure that the systems themselves, due to a variety of random errors and, you know, just regular techie database stuff, doesn't lose data. I mean, you know, someone has to do that work. And so, you know, our concern then was, you know, are people just sort of falling down on the job? Now, eventually we got most of that fixed, but that, you know, that we went to the public with that, and the Hispanic Caucus in Congress wrote a letter to the Department of Justice about that. Elizabeth Warren spoke out about that. Many reporters covered that as a really important, you know, concern. So we do have to fight for it. And when we find issues, we either litigate or we try to alert the public.
Yeah, I found that. I mean, this wasn't something else that was surprising for me, is that the federal government, with all of its resources, really is not doesn't have great data management systems. You'd think they're the government, and you know, it's sort of their job to collect and keep data. It's a big part of what they do, and they just, you know, they just don't have the infrastructure, where their computer systems are very, very old and antiquated. So that's definitely, I can imagine how that impacts you all, who, you know, you're in the business of data.
Yeah, very much.
Is there, and you know, this is, I asked our team if they had questions for you, because, you know, again, we have a team that's very data centric and they're really into these types of questions, and they were excited that I was talking to you. And so this came from our team, and it was, has there been a moment where you were surprised by something uncovered via a FOIA or data that you collected, you know, something that's like, what, like, you know, like that, you know, that just discovery that was unexpected?
That's a great question. Because of the nature of Track's work, I think that we don't necessarily tend to come across a lot of surprises. You know, one of my colleagues, Jason Leopold at BuzzFeed, does a lot of FOIA work, and he's always sending FOIAs about documents relating to interesting things and comes across all kinds of accidents. In fact, just yesterday, he got a FOIA back from ICE, and ICE forgot to redact all of the documents. So he got this trove of documents completely unredacted, you know, and now they're trying to pull the documents back, you know, and he's posting them online, you know, it's great. We don't really experience that quite as much, because we really know very precisely what we're going after. And it's because it's databases. The only things that we're asking for are things that we know are there. So it's a little bit more predictable. However, I'll just give you an example of one interesting thing that I think has come up recently. This initially happened before I started at Track, but I've become a little bit embroiled in it too. You know, we took ICE to court because, you know, Track noticed, you know, in 2015, 2016, there was a big change in how the agency was answering FOIA requests and what they were providing. They were no longer providing what people were asking for. And, you know, we were perplexed. Other people are perplexed. And it turns out in court, under, you know, a testimony, someone at ICE talked about the fact that ICE actually made a secret decision back around that time, that decided that they weren't going to answer FOIA requests in the way that they were requested, you know. And it's kind of mind blowing. Somebody had a meeting with some attorneys, and they decided, we're just not going to provide this data anymore. We're just going to, you know, we're going to curtail the scope of what we're providing. So that was a surprise, you know. And of course, you know, we're in court trying to fight that, obviously, because we don't think that that's right. We don't think that a couple of people in a closed door office should be making decisions that are not in the public, but are essentially determining the FOIA policy of an entire agency, that's not, you know, consistent with how federal policymaking should work. So that was a surprise. But that happens. But some of the other kinds of surprises that FOIA requesters come across, we are less likely to come across that same kind of thing. Again, just because we don't go after a lot of those underlying records, we kind of go after data that we know what we're looking for.
That absolutely makes sense. If you were to offer recommendations, to the administration regarding how DHS collects and shares data, what would you say? What would your response be if they were to ask you for areas of improvement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to, for us anyway, okay, so two big things. One is, for us, we would like to have a collegial working relationship with agencies. You know, we don't want to be suing people in court. That costs the government money. It costs us time and resources. We don't want to do that. So we would much rather work things out. And we wish that the disposition of some of these agencies would be more, slanted towards disclosure and working, with, a research institute like ours, which, we think that we provide a service not just to the public, but to agencies. We do kinds of analysis that the agencies themselves don't do because it's not their expertise. It's not what they're tasked to do and all of that. So it could be very collaborative, in that sense. And we wish that that disposition would, that would be the disposition of agencies. There's been a big shift at the immigration courts. With those records that we found that went missing, the Trump administration was very resistant to responding. They just fought us on responding responsibly. And we were literally like, look, it looks like you're missing a whole bunch of records. We're doing data validation for you that you're not doing yourself. Just tell us that you're going to look into it. Like, have a look, like just have a conversation with us. And they stonewalled us. Very nice to see that more recently that the immigration courts, the EOIR, has been more collaborative and has reached out. And so that's great news. I mean, that's how it should work. I have my criticisms as a researcher and as someone who's been involved in immigrant rights activism about these institutions. But in terms of my job at TRAC, our position is one of collaboration, ideally. So that's good to see. So we hope that would happen more often. And I think the larger, thing is, and I'm drawing here on Margaret Kuoppa's new book on Saving the Freedom of Information Act, where she shows that more than half of all FOIA requests at the federal government are for immigration. Half of all FOIA requests sent in are immigration related. And the vast majority of those are not ones from TRAC. They're from people in removal proceedings or people who are seeking immigration benefits of some kind, who don't have any other mechanism for getting their own records from the federal government. And so, just a broader suggestion is we really need, and Margaret Kuoppa makes this argument really well in her book, we just need FOIA reform in a way that allows people who are doing government oversight work like us to be able to get our FOIA requests responded to more quickly, because that was why FOIA was created. It was created to provide oversight and accountability for the government. Whereas people who are facing deportation in immigration court, why are they filing FOIA requests to get their own A files? The ICE trial attorney sitting right across them in the courtroom, they've got the A file. These records should be much more easily forthcoming. Agencies should not be swamped with FOIA requests for things like this. But again, unfortunately, there's no disclosure in removal proceedings, and there's all kinds of other barriers to getting records from the federal government. So, when the federal government, as it often does, complains about the large number of FOIA requests it gets, especially for immigration reasons, I would just say, well, great, give people an option, provide another way for people to get the records that they need. So, so those would be my, be nice and play well with others. That would be my policy recommendation.
Yeah, it's a surprise at how willing the government is to waste resources in some instances and how we think about savings in others. It's like, it's, just give individuals their files, make it accessible online. You know, I just have a couple more questions for you. You know, one question that I had for you, you know, I know I've, you know that you've spoken about this and I've seen you post about this. And this is how organizations and how groups can access and use data. And I guess specifically, what role do you see track playing? You know, I think for us as an immigrant rights organization, but, you know, I think this can apply to any group that wants to advocate on behalf of immigrants. What role do you see track, you know, playing as a resource for those types of groups?
Yeah, well, because our immigration data is public, you know, I see track as playing a role for, you know, anyone who wants to understand how the immigration system works at a really detailed level, really get their heads around, like, how many new people, how many new cases are filed each month in immigration court, who is being put in removal proceedings in terms of nationality, gender now, you know, who's getting asylum, you know, which courts and which judges are more favorable for asylum and not favorable for asylum, and why. So, you know, it's sort of true for the whole, what's true for the immigrant rights organization is kind of like true for the whole public. We provide a lot of data and a lot of reports and detailed reports and detailed data that allow anyone to get their head around it. I will say, as someone who ran a worker center, so I was one of the co-founders of the Central Ohio Worker Center back in Columbus, Ohio, and we advocated for working class people and immigrants and people of color in the city. And, you know, one of the things that I was involved in while I was there was, and this was after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, 2017, you know, we made a concerted effort to reach out to city council in that city and to say, look, immigration is a big thing right now with this administration. You know, the city should do what it can to provide, you know, whatever level of safety and assurances that it can, that immigrants are going to be, you know, safe or as safe as possible in the city, that they're part of the community. And this was before I even worked at Track, but I used Track's data to go to city council and say, look, here's the data. You know, here's some data on how many people in this county are facing deportation right now. How does that compare to other counties across the state, across the Midwest, across the country? And by taking that data and working it into an argument with elected officials about the importance of paying attention to immigration and to immigrants, we were able to make a pretty successful pitch for enacting some meaningful local reforms that, you know, did some good in terms of, you know, sort of keeping immigrants from getting wrapped up in that, you know, whole enforcement scheme. So that was an example of taking data and, you know, and putting it into a narrative. So that's what I would say for organizations in the immigrant rights movement or who do that work is, you know, use the data to understand what's going on in the immigration system. Just because organizations care about immigrant rights or people care about immigrant rights doesn't mean that they necessarily understand the system. So it does take some effort to understand how things work and to understand the data that Track has. Once you do that, then, you know, I would say using that data and working it into narratives by people who are affected, that's the most important thing. The data, so in some ways, the data can speak for itself about, like, you know, comparing, you know, certain things and drawing some general conclusions. But I would say take the data and put it into a narrative that helps to provide, that helps to humanize the data. Because if you just treat immigration as a data problem, that can be really dehumanizing. So putting those two things together are really important. But again, I would say for anyone who is interested in infecting change in their community, elected officials will respond better when you can show that you have a grasp of the data. Because for better or worse, I have mixed feelings about whether or not this should be the case, but for better or worse, elected officials want to see numbers. And if you show them numbers about something, it will open the door to more conversation. Part of that is good because I do think that people need to have a grasp on the actual data that's there. Some of it's a little bit of, you know, people don't trust narratives. People want to see data. And I think that that sometimes is more of a problem than a solution. But anyway, it can be an asset, you know, to you if you're trying to affect change.
That makes complete sense. And yeah, last question that I have, and we sort of end all of our podcasts with this. Yeah. And it's, what does freedom mean to you?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's a big concept. You know, it's freedom is different. What is the difference between freedom and justice? You know, what is the relationship between freedom and justice? You know, I think of, because I'm a geographer and because I'm involved in this kind of work, I think, you know, I think that freedom, well, first of all, freedom is, it doesn't have a definition. It doesn't have a set meaning. It is a powerful concept because it lacks a simple, straightforward definition. And it matters so much who is answering the question and who should be answering the question about freedom. So I think it's sort of like justice. I think the question of what freedom is to me is less about just like how you define freedom and more about what does it mean to be unfree? What does unfreedom mean? Because freedom only makes sense, you know, to me in the concept of unfreedom. So who is unfree? Who is asking the question about, you know, and answering the question about what unfreedom looks like? So what freedom looks like for me, you know, is going to be very different from someone else. But, you know, I think a lot about freedom of movement, freedom of mobility, just because it's such a geographic concept, because as a geographer, I think a lot about people and space and the ability to move. And I think that, you know, freedom of movement and mobility and freedom of migration is something that's, you know, it's not just about borders. It's not just what should be the freedom of people to request asylum, to request sanctuary, you know, to find a place where they can live unencumbered by oppression and marginalization. It's about borders, but it's not just about borders. It's about, you know, what about these alternatives to detention technologies where, you know, where we have people who have been incarcerated, you know, in prisons and are now being incarcerated in their homes because they have to wear a GPS ankle shackle that prevents them from basically leaving their house without having to go back into, you know, a prison. So freedom of mobility and freedom of movement is also about those people. It's about being able to move in your own city. I mean, how many cities have been built around racist infrastructure? You know, I'm in Syracuse right now, and, you know, I'm looking at the freeway. It's a very controversial freeway here in Syracuse where they built the freeway and it just divided communities of color from white communities and entrenched poverty. And just because we built these systems of mobility so that some people can move very freely in this city while other people can. Same is true in Atlanta. When they built the bus and train infrastructure in Atlanta, you know, those counties on the outskirts where white flight, where people fled the, you know, racial integration in Atlanta, those buses and trains stop at the county line because those counties prevented those infrastructures from extending into those counties because of, you know, racial concerns. And so I think a lot about freedom of mobility, freedom of migration, and think that, you know, whether it's borders, whether it's freeways, whether it's public transportation, I just want to see a world where people have the freedom to move and to interact with one another in a way that's not so profoundly structured by race and racism.
That's such a great answer. No one's answered this when it comes to mobility and, you know, like that. What's happening in Syracuse really resonates with me because I grew up in the Bronx, which was completely broken apart by highways under Robert Moses over the course of 50 some odd years. So yeah, it's just one way in which we're, you know, like we people are, you know, the ways in which we move, our mobility is limited. And, you know, this is not discussed enough when it comes to immigration. We think of immigration solely as being an issue, you know, pretty much that doesn't go beyond the border, or that's a issue, you know, the interior US, and we don't think about the global drivers of migration and how we limit mobility from really around the world. So I really, you know, appreciate that definition of freedom. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Austin. This was super fascinating. It's a little different for us. You know, we're a bunch of data nerds here, and so we talk about it, but we haven't had a chance to talk about this on the podcast yet, and to tie it into the issues that we work on. So we really, really appreciate you coming on, and we appreciate the work that Trek does, and the support that Trek is able to provide for immigrant rights movements, or that we're able to extract from your work. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I appreciate your work. I mean, your organization is really valuable. And I I've known about you guys for a while and really appreciate your work too. So pleasure to get to meet you.
All right. Thank you so much. And thanks so much for joining us this week, listeners. Until next time, we're out.
Dismantling Injustice is a project of Envision Freedom Fund. Our creator is Saleh Israel. Our producer is Michael Bray, and I'm Carl Hammond-Lipscomb. To learn more about our work or to donate, visit us online at envisionfreedom.org or follow us on social media.